Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik Palmgren. This is Red Ice Radio. We are very glad to have you with us today. The website is redice.tv. Please check it out for more radio shows, videos, our TV show, and of course, our busy news section as well. Today, we have Jay Dyer back on the show. He's behind Jay's Analysis. You might know Jay as a public speaker, lecturer, comedian, and author, as well as the host of Jay's Analysis. He has a podcast called Esoteric Hollywood. He's a regular contributor to other websites and covers subjects as wide as satire, metaphysics, film analysis, theology, geopolitics, literature, and history. Welcome back to the show, Jay. Good to have you back again.
Thank you, Henrik. I always enjoy having discussions with you. You're one of the best interviewers that I get to talk to.
Well, thank you, Jay. I appreciate that. That's great. I mean, today we're going to speak about your latest book, Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. I'm really looking forward to this. We've touched upon this in one capacity or another, most of the interviews that we've done, Jay. Mm-hmm. My take on this is kind of is the following. I mean, to understand something, you need to study it. And to destroy something, you need to learn as much as you can about it. You need to find out its weaknesses, what it's built on, how to use those advantages against the thing that you're trying to destroy. And I think Hollywood has been a propaganda tool like nothing else the world has ever seen. It has transformed America, and then America has transformed the world, mostly through, I think, cultural domination, and military, of course, mm-hmm. as well, but through culture, you know. So I see Hollywood as kind of a virus or the software that has been installed into the hardware that is America. And now the culture itself has become an enemy of life, of decency, of tradition, the family, every wholesome value that mankind in most countries, most part of the world, has, you know, treasured for thousands of years. And we now live in a degenerated culture in a large part thanks to Hollywood. And I think it's been, you know, with the cooperation, maybe with a few other agencies, if you will, that this has been the single most destructive thing that we have seen for culture and for morality as well. So, you know, my take on this is, Jay, that I want to be part of destroying Hollywood. I want to know what makes it tick so that we can take it down, so that we can replace it with something that still, of course, tells engaging stories, but does that with the health of our people in mind and with decency in mind, without the cultural Marxism, something that, you know, tells the true heroic stories that we have in our mythological and historical record. I mean, entertainment is such a vital part of the 21st century, and it's not going to go away, I think, anyway soon. So what would you say that we need to know to destroy Hollywood? I mean, it's history, what it was built on, you know, why it was built. All these things, you know, are very important. But I think what you've focused on is also kind of the metaphysical aspect to how it became so popular. And in most cases, it's not what we just have right in front of our eyes, in front of our face that drives this. It's a deeper understanding of the human drives, the emotions, the psychology, the hidden aspects of our desire, our dreams, and ultimately, I'd say, the symbolism that drives this on an occult level, Jay.
Yeah, that's a great introduction. And what are we looking at with Hollywood? Well, I think we're looking at Plato's cave. And if you go all the way back to Plato's Republic, he discussed the censorship of the arts. And the reason he talked about censorship of the arts was not because he was just some sort of tyrant, but because he understood that when, quote, democracy or the rule of the mob got a hold of the levers of power, and by the way, Plato is who said long ago that it was actually moneyed oligarchy that was always behind democracy, because they would gain power by appealing to man's baser desires. And I mean, that's really what democracy amounts to in praxis, right? As it functions, it necessitates those who rise to power being able to be the most conniving, to be the most manipulative, and to sway the herd most easily through, as I said, appealing to base desires. And so as you debase the culture, you make it much easier to sway in any direction. And I think that with the advent of the camera, which from the inception of the camera, you know, it was directly connected to military strategies and to warfare and so forth. And they saw the value of what the camera could do for propaganda, which, you know, propaganda is the main aspect of warfare, as we know from Sun Tzu, even said that a long time ago, psyops, right? It's not so much the battlefield as it is winning the hearts and minds of the enemy. So if we talk about, think all the way back to Plato and Plato's cave, Plato said that the shadows on the wall, you know, this allegory that we've heard so many times in the Republic, these constitute a false reality. And so put in philosophical terms, my book is just an attempt to say, look, there's a veneer, a synthetic veneer, a screen that's been pulled across your eyes to give you a means by which to interpret the world, the external world. And that screen is fake. It's synthetic. It's a form of storytelling. It's ancient actors dressing up like the gods and calling upon them and pretending to be something more than they are. And so, you know, storytelling, all the way back to Homer and Odysseus and all that, is a part of culture. It's a part of tradition, actually, as you pointed out with mythology. But it can also be engineered, and that's the main point that Plato's trying to get at as to why you can't have completely licentious freedom of the arts. There has to be some notion of objective aesthetics and beauty, and in some sense, censoring. Because if you don't, well, then bestiality isn't just natural, right? I mean, NAMBLA, pedophilia, oh, these are just natural good rights or something absurd like that, which is what we actually see being pushed now. And the way that that's going to be maneuvered into normalcy, it will be through the same means that maneuvered homosexuality and transgenderism into, quote, normalcy, which they're not normal, but the attempt, of course, is to alter the perception of normalcy through the arts, through entertainment. So you have this long trend of the debasement of the arts on purpose, and we know that, for example, the Frankfurt School, which is that critical tradition of Marxism out of Germany, that was exported, or I should say imported, to the U.S. via the OSS and via the Rockefeller Foundation for the purpose of toxic culture. And what toxic culture does is that it allows, and by the way, the absurdity of this idea, why would you bring a bunch of Frankfurt School Marxists over to the U.S. and import this stupid ideology? Oh, well, to fight the Nazis. That's literally what the OSS said the reason was for.
Right. Yep.
For bringing these Frankfurt School scumbags over. Interesting. To fight the Nazis, which is preposterous. But that's even in Foreign Policy magazine, by the way. Hmm. Now, the debasement, then, is something that at that time, yeah, there were aspects of Hollywood, but you used to have this Hollywood, the Catholic Code, which was to some degree enforced on Hollywood, you know, in the 40s and 50s. Well, this eventually lost sway, especially with the time of the 60s and what I believe was a socially engineered revolution, you know, free love and all that. And, of course, with the predominance of the Jewish element in Hollywood, what you got was basically liberalism coming to the fore. And yeah, you could argue that liberalism was always there in some degree, but I actually think that the Red Scare in Hollywood, I kind of think that was trumped up, exaggerated, not because there was no real threat from liberalism or socialism, but that rather this played into the Cold War dialectic, and that you had, as Quigley says, the large foundations actually in the background of all of the leftist groups in America. So, you know, when we think of Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, this is who's behind a lot of these leftist groups, as I mentioned earlier, the Frankfurt School as well. So, yeah, we can speak of a communist, Marxist infiltration, quote unquote, of Hollywood, but actually, I think that the entire apparatus has been there all along as a kind of tool for propaganda and social engineering. That's why from the outset, you know, there were military strategists, people from the Pentagon, interested in film, interested in camera, interested in mass media. You know, the founders of CBS are Sarnoff, Paley. You know, these are people straight from the OSS, and I don't think that's accidental. So it's not something that was taken over or was infiltrated necessarily. I think it went from bad to worse, really, is the best way to put it. So what my book is an attempt to look at various popular films. And so I begin the book, you know, looking at film itself as a kind of ritual action. I look at Kubrick's films, and I look at, in the first 100 pages or so, the notion of Hollywood metaphysics, right? So what is the worldview that Hollywood is trying to send us with, you know, some of these, quote, top films of all time? You know, most people would say, you know, Hitchcock or Kubrick or Spielberg, or, you know, these are considered the, you know, top directors of all time and so forth. So what is the message? Is it all just about making money? And I think that's the main force or thrust or argument of my book, is that it's not just a monetary, a money-making scheme. I mean, that's certainly an element of it, but that it goes much, much deeper, and you've had a long, long bedfellow relationship between intelligence agencies, between mafia, mob elements, and black market elements, and Hollywood, as well as the Pentagon and so forth, and the degeneration of the culture. Is kind of a symbiotic relationship, right, between the degeneration of Hollywood and the degeneration of the culture, and that's where we are today. So I'll let you ask the next question, since I'm on a rambling spree.
No, it's good. I wanted to get a kind of an overview a little bit of the book, of course. It's always good to get that. We'll you know, a little bit later in the show, I want to talk more specifically about some of the films. You've done so many good, you've done a lot of good analysis, of course, of many other top movies. And this is always very interesting to get into. But let's talk a bit more about the mentality first, and try to convey this idea to people of what it is that it is. Because I think you made an extremely important point when you said it's not about, you know, making money. I mean, that's a good side effect. It's a good thing to have. But it's, I think the money-making machine that Hollywood had turned into is kind of a means to an end. It's something that, you know, they use to fund the next project, right? So that they can continue basically with the process of degenerating the culture, and it not only pays off and they can be rich in the process, it allows them and ensures that they can, you know, produce the next one and the next one and the next one. But you mentioned something interesting, winning the hearts and the minds of the enemy. Should we see this as a system that sees us as an enemy, that they're using, you know, these various techniques of occult, you know, manners and symbolism and these kinds of things to win over us? Is it in this way that we should view the motion picture industry of the U.S.?
I would say if you could view it as a giant single organism or entity, yes. But I don't think that it translates into being that simple, you know, with every single person involved, obviously, right? So, I mean, was Stanley Kubrick some sort of nefarious person who wanted to, you know, destroy everybody in America? I don't know, because I don't know what his actual motivations were, but I can look at his artwork and see what I think he was trying to convey, which, you know, appears to be created in tandem to some degree with elements of the establishment. But at the same time, you also have an anti-establishment, Tennessee and Kubrick, for example, doing something like Spartacus. But unfortunately, the message of Spartacus is the communist, illuminist revolution, right?
Right.
Because Spartacus is the slave revolt. Now, that, I believe, played into the false dialectic of the Hollywood 10 and the Red Scare and all that, which I really, really, truly think, to be properly understood, is not. For example, Quigley explains the history of the Communist Party in America, and even at its highest numbers, it only had, he says something like in the tens of thousands. And then after a couple decades, it had dwindled down to 3,000. So it's not straight up communism as an ideology that was the real threat or danger to America. It was more so the toxic cultural communism or cultural Marxism that we talked about earlier. And yeah. I think the first time you had me on, you know, we talked about the Frankfurt School, and I studied under a guy in my undergrad who had studied under a Frankfurt School person. So I know it pretty well firsthand from people from that tradition, if it can be called the anti-tradition.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to unfairly paint it all as one complete entity, because you do have differing ideas from say between Habermas and Horkheimer and Adorno, they don't necessarily agree on all the points. But the idea is just that they're thinking post-World War II, since Marx was not right about everything and we had these world wars, we can't really expect any kind of revolution of the proletariat. What can we expect? Well, the only thing that we can do is do culture critique, right?
Yep.
In the German, and culture critique, which would mean that we could tear down the edifice through culture. And this idea, I think, is what's the most insidious and most dangerous, is that before you could have any kind of political change, the thinking is you've got to destroy the culture first. And that's what they saw and they implemented, really. Now, does that mean that every single individual out there is secretly, a part of the Frankfurt School or some secret Marxist? It doesn't work that way, because it's more so about a general ideology of just constantly, say, for example, promoting democracy. So you'll see a lot of movies that would, promote it might be something like To Kill a Mockingbird or something, right? And you've got the betrayal of the perpetual victim of the slave or something like that, or the segregated South or something like this, and how evil it is, and it's not a part of American democracy or something like this, right? And so you have decades and decades of films that are put out promoting something like just generic, like democracy. Well, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the American Republican system, but it's not a democracy, right?
Right.
So that's just one way of kind of nudging over decades of moving something in a liberal direction that kind of gets people just sort of subconsciously. You know, you've grown up for all these years watching all these movies and hearing all your favorite actors and actresses talking about freedom and democracy, and you just identify it with just sort of loose association in your mind, right? With America is democracy, right? And the same could be said with anything else, right? Like America represents liberation and rights. Well, I mean, maybe you could argue that from natural rights and the Declaration of Independence or something, but it's always fuzzy notions, and it's all sold through emotion. And that's what's so powerful about Hollywood, is that it's able to tell stories to change your perception of the world or your thoughts based
your morality,
on emotion.
Right?
Your morality. Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And emotion through film, and as we said many times, I think you and I talked about it. I mean, film is able to implement different art forms, right? So, I mean, if you just went to an art show and you saw Jackson Pollock's vomit on a big banner or something, right? That's like just his rainbow vomit, Skittle vomit or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you go to a movie, you get to see the manipulation of time through the editing of the film. You get to hear music, beautiful orchestral sounds in the background. You hear and see various, color palettes and, all sorts of, sparkling glitz and glamour on the screen. And so it's a much more powerful medium, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. It's in a way, it's magic. It is a kind of a dark wizardry, because
exactly.
we've never experienced anything like this before. I mean, think of it in evolutionary terms even.
Right.
How long we've developed and the art form of storytelling has been with us for a long time. Moving into theater or who knows, like shadow puppet plays or something, but this is on such a different level where every emotion you can be played on those, every aspect of movie magic. And we have this issue again of at what point does your brain start differentiating between reality and what you actually see on the screen? And if you have a fairly unconscious audience, I think when you come out of that movie theater, you're going to have embedded in you experiences which you think are going, that they are yours, right? As opposed to something subjectively or objectively experienced, right?
Yes, I like the idea that you're kind of downloaded, right? I think Alan Watts speaks that way, that Hollywood gives you the latest download of what's PC or what's appropriate. So that is an accurate assessment of its function for, I mean, I remember in the 90s, it was like, you could still say something like faggot in a movie. Right.
Right. Yep.
Now this is like total, oh my gosh, like everybody would have a hissy fit and would freak out if anybody dared to say something like that.
Oh yeah.
Unless it was a, some certain context, right? Or I guess if you're Sarah Silverman, you can, you're, it's okay. You can say,
yeah. Or like Seth Rogen or something.
Or Seth Rogen. Yeah, right.
Right.
But anybody else dares to say it, then, oh, it's you're a racist, you're a Nazi or something. But that the introduction and in the first chapter that deal with this aspect of it, this film as ritual and a cult empire is hitting at what you're getting at. That's, in other words, what I'm trying to get at in those chapters is what you're saying, that it's a form of, you could look at it like black magic or voodoo. And even if it's not like a literal invocation of spirits that are, you know, casting their spell upon you or whatever, waving the wand over your head, it's more or less the same effect.
Right.
See what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
Which is, I guess, your point, that it's a kind of wizardry. It's like, I mean, the Wizard of Oz is a kind of, in a way, you can read it as an allegory of Hollywood and mass media.
Did you see that the new one, from 2010?
Was this the one with like all the racial cast, the colored cast?
Yeah, well, yeah. Tell me one that isn't like that today. Let me just see. Not Wizard of Oz. It was, damn it. I'm mixing it together probably with one now, but there was a very interesting remake of one of them, and I'll search it and find it here while we're talking. But it was basically the whole movie you could actually interpret as a kind of a celebration to the movie industry itself. It was kind of in a veiled way showing how they managed to change the perception of these people in this town. Of basically they were turning against their own king and threw him out and then adopted a new one. For
is
the
this
sake.
The James Franco version
yes,
of it?
Yes,
I remember
exactly.
That. Yes, it's. I remember thinking this is like a Marxist.
It was amazing. Actually,
it's like a Marxist revolution.
Yeah,
within the Wizard of Oz kingdom or something.
Yeah,
exactly.
And in the beginning, you didn't kind of as they have been doing now with the dark and the light, or the evil and the good. You don't know in the beginning. It's like it's confusing these days. The lines are beginning to blur. You know, you were introduced by these characters in the beginning where you're like, oh, these are clearly evil ones, right? And then they shifted around and it turns out that those you thought were evil were actually the good ones, and they're saving this town by kicking out the evil king and things like that. But it literally was like an overturning of culture, and they demonstrated in the movie that it was done with the aid of the movie technology. Mm-hmm. You know?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, Wizard of Oz is a perfect allegory for Hollywood, even if that might not have been the original intention, obviously, of the author. Frank Baum wasn't
right.
Trying to talk about Hollywood, but it works perfectly for Hollywood or for mass media or whatever. But that's what and the chapter two, when I get into Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, when I started off with that at the very beginning on purpose, because it's not just, you know, one of the more popular analyses that I've written, but it's also appropriate for how I think society really works. I mean, we saw, you know, with these Podesta emails and the spirit cooking and all this kind of stuff, or what's at least hinted at in those emails, something roughly close to what we see presented, you know, in Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut.
That's right.
Right, where you have this degenerate sort of billionaire class elite that appear to love Aleister Crowley and his sort of sex magic or whatever, and this is who's running things, right? This is kind of the Hollywood crowd, and we all know that, you know, that type of degeneracy is very popular in Hollywood, and so it's not surprising that they're then foisting this upon everybody through the what I call celluloid chapels, which is what we could call a movie theater, really.
You know, I want to get deeper into that in a minute. I want to dwell just a little bit more on the motivations or maybe the intentions of transformation of culture. And this is, frankly, this is might be something that has also developed over time. I'm not saying that there was a monolithic idea initially, which was like, we're going to pervert culture and that's it. And then, you know, you've just had thousands of people working all the same in that one direction. Clearly, it's not as black and white as that. But at some point, I think that there was a realization that Hollywood, I think it was in the beginning. I think when it was set up, the big, when the big studios were set up, an empire of their own, Hollywoodism. Many of the Jews that came to Hollywood, they set this up and started this, and saw perhaps a culture which was maybe to them not inclusive. It didn't let them in. In a way, it did. Mm-hmm. In a way, it did actually. But I think innately they felt as outsiders. Whether they actually were let in or not, I think they felt as being somehow different, and they saw that, you know, over time, when you had, you know, the rise of National Socialism in Germany, the Frankfurt School kicked out and all these kinds of things, I think it's weaved into this. You kind of had an innate so-called anti-fascism that has also driven the Frankfurt School, that they feared the authoritarian man, they feared tradition, they feared a nation of, or a people of, you know, getting together and pulling in the same direction, and them maybe not being included in that. And I think that Hollywood potentially at some point down the line here was seen as a tool to help to change that morality, help to transform that possibility, to make sure that, you know, they weren't put in a position of danger. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think if you watch the documentary that you mentioned there, Empire of Their Own, which discusses the role of four or five, you know, prominent Jews in the rise of the studio system in the earliest days, you have kind of this WASP dominance early on, right? So like Edison and people that were directly involved in the camera, creation of the camera and so forth, and development of it. Jews would be considered outsiders to this. And this is, you know, lauded and praised in the documentary, which is, of course, made by Jews, discussing the fact that they were not seen as welcome into the kind of WASP establishment. And then you also have a kind of Catholic establishment. And then you have this rising Jewish establishment over time. But it takes a few generations. And what's interesting is that the studio heads, according to the documentary, they kind of married into, you know, they married Gentile wives and
right.
kind of attempted to hide, you know, their Jewish past by, you know, changing their names. And then you have many of those actors in the early days, you know, changing their name, actresses too, changing their name. So it's not as black and white as, the Jews, you know, did this to destroy everything. It's more of I don't think that everybody knew exactly what was going to happen. I mean, the earliest days of the camera and the, you know, say the military people who were interested in filming propaganda films, like back in, say, the 20s or 30s, I don't think they were intent on destroying the culture, right? They saw this as a means by which, oh, you could actually influence people. Well, yeah, and then over time, you know, influencing people becomes, actually, we can actually destroy this people. So you do over time get that attitude. But I also don't necessarily buy into the idea that, you know, that a lot of the leftists in Hollywood are, you know, a lot of them are not fans of the state of Israel. So I'm not trying to get into a big Israel debate. But what I'm saying is that I think a lot of these people would be more accurately classified as straight up liberal or straight up atheist or
globalist in a way, right?
I mean, I don't think they have any religious commitments unless they're like Acrolians or something like that.
Right.
But it does fit into a larger geopolitical paradigm of, you know, a long time relationship in the British aristocracy with the Jews that were allowed to come back post Cromwell, and then the Royal Society. So I've read, at least I can't prove this, but people have sort of whispered about the fact that it was decided that Hollywood would not be established in London. Or in any connection with the Globe Theater Shakespeare, but that it would actually be set up in California, that America would kind of be the engine for spreading Americanism to the globe via Hollywood.
Right.
And so there have been discussions of that on the part of the Royal Society. But as to how true that is, I'm not 100% positive. But regardless, it fits into the larger geopolitical paradigm because, in my view, Israel, if you look at the Mackinder Doctrine and Halford Mackinder's work on the Heartland Theory, he discusses the need. This is prior to the establishment of Israel. He discusses the need for the British Empire to establish a permanent Israeli Zionist state there as a geopolitical motive for kind of an outpost for the Anglo-American establishment. So now, does that mean that I'm saying that there are no powerful Zionists? No, I'm not saying that. Does that mean that I'm saying that all evil English people run the world? Not necessarily. No. I mean, I'm English myself. Dyer is an English name.
Right.
So I'm English and Scottish, but
you Anglos, you clearly control the globe.
Yeah, right.
Was it the Anglo menace, right? That's funny.
Yeah, and then, of course, and again, it gets more complicated because you have, once the British Empire allows the Zionist state to set up after the Sykes-Picot and Balfour Declaration, you have the bombing of the King David Hotel because the radical Zionist elements are sick of the British.
Yeah.
They're sick of British troops everywhere in Israel, so they try to get rid of them. Well, this is Menachem Ben David, I think.
Yeah.
And the Irgun. So anyway, it was way off topic, but back to Hollywood. So, you know, there's a lot of difficult elements in trying to trace all the history of where it might have come from. Obviously, the idea of this does go back to Shakespeare and the Globe Theater, and I get into that and how there was a kind of alchemical notion behind Shakespeare's writings and the idea of controlling perception, right? That we're all actors on the stage and all that stuff. But perception management is really a big part of Hollywood because in my view, and what I argue in the book, is that mass media is not really that different from Hollywood. They're kind of the same entity, and they're just kind of different angles of looking at the same thing. And that's why I think you have mainstream mass news using so many techniques of Hollywood.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a trade-off between the different factions. They learn from each other. They study each other. What do you say that this boils down to? I mean, we talked about, of course, the changing of perception of morality and these kinds of things. But ultimately, if we look a step further than that, management and control, right? A way to dictate uncertainty, to making sure that human beings is turned into a very simple or a simplified unit that you can control in different ways. That's how I see some of the mentality with the lap over into intelligence services, into, you know, the Tavistocks and, you know, all this kind of stuff that they want to manage mankind. And they've realized, as you said, to go back to that you opened with, that if they can control people and the hearts and minds of their enemies right away, they will never have to go to war. They will never have to bother with any of that because they'll have everything under control already. Do you think that's a driving factor in this?
Yes, absolutely. Because I think the first talk that we had, we discussed the trek of philosophy in the West and metaphysics and how the gradual descent into empiricism and materialism kind of brings along with it all this other baggage that will affect the rest of your view of life, you know. For example, so if I say, suddenly I decide I'm just I've read Richard Dawkins and I believe everything's just material and matter in motion. There's no spirit. There's no metaphysics. That's going to inevitably affect the rest of how I view things, right? So if I were to be consistent with this, and people I think get more consistent with their views over time, even if they're not initially fully cognizant of it, they will eventually become more and more consistent with their presupposition. So if I believe that everything is just meaningless matter in motion, then it doesn't really matter what I do. It doesn't really matter if we make films that glorify pedophilia or that that promote transgenderism or wreck people's lives or marriages or gender or whatever, because nothing matters. There's no prima facie reason to choose one over the other between doing it or not doing it. And if one option seems to grant me more mammon, then why not do that? Right. So this right. is all the it's all called the consequence of a long track, I would say, of thought and philosophy, bad philosophy and thought. And it plays itself out in the way that people live their lives and the way that they view the world. And your art is always, of course, a kind of a reflection of a culture. It's a reflection of the spirit of a people. And once you, through, you know, the CIA, for example, working with Andy Warhol, with Jackson Pollock, literally, by the way, to promote the idea that the garbage degenerate art that they were doing is, you know, quote, high art, and, oh, you've got to be really, really deep to understand this, or, oh, you just don't get art, right? That's how we get Marina Abramovich, right, dominating the art sphere with Lady Gaga, right, and hanging out with these people.
Right.
And we're told that they're these they're the great genius artists. They're absolutely not. They're just said to be that by sort of divine fiat of the establishment. But that's because they've learned perception management. They've learned how to socially engineer. And Hollywood was a big means to do that. And by the way, I should add, there's a section of the book where I discuss, I mean, you're more right than you were probably even aware, because it's like one of the last chapters in the book, Henrik, where it discusses literally studying the way that people reacted in a kind of scientific sense to Hitchcock films. See how that might be used in, say, propaganda or mass media, right? So if we shock people, and what's the react? Oh, they're running out of the theater. Oh, they're, you know, pissing their pants as they're watching, you know, somebody get stabbed in the shower or something. This can be utilized in psyops. This can be utilized in mass media, right? I mean, these are all techniques, and I'm not joking about it. You think that sounds extreme? No, it's actually that specified and studied out from a Psy War perspective. They even know like how to construct a crash scene in a film such that it, you know, causes the body to, you know, the heart rate to increase and so forth. Yeah. All of that has been scientifically studied. And so absolutely, it's about viewing people as sort of automatons or meaningless numerical units to be swayed in some direction.
Yeah. You open the book with a quote from Marilyn Monroe. She says, "Hollywood is a place where they'll pay you $1,000 for a kiss and 50 cents for your soul. I know, because I turned down the first offer often enough and held out for the 50 cents." So there is this kind of saying, I guess, in Hollywood that the industry is soulless, right? There's a, or if nothing else, it may be, and this is the more interesting aspect of it, it sucks out your soul. It destroys your soul. It is consumed maybe partially by the hungry audience, if you will, that themselves in many cases are lacking of spirit, and they go and try to fill this hole and the need that they have for experiences and various things. That's more, of course, of a deeper psychological discussion we can have about the human condition. But my point is that there seems to be a because I wouldn't say that it's soulless. I would say that it's filled with a spirit, but it's very dark. There is accusations very frequently that it's a kind of a satanic element that drives Hollywood, that there is a religiosity to it, but it's a very different one than you know, classic religious morality. What would you say about this in terms of what people should know when it comes to Satanism as it's weaved into Hollywood?
Well, I think that California as a whole is kind of a longtime mecca for all manner of alternative lifestyles, quote unquote, or fringe religious movements and sects and so forth. And you see in the history of California, all kinds, at least in the 20th century, all of these different movements popping up and flowering and coming and going and so forth. You have the Children of God with David Berg. You have the Jesus People movement. You have Scientology. You have all kinds of what's that? Esalen Institute, which is a big New Age mind control entity out there. Aldous Huxley, you know, and actual MKUltra doctors are part of the Esalen Institute. You've got all kinds of Kabbalah centers out there, and I think that it's naturally, yes, you have the creation of the Church of Satan out there with Anton LaVey, which is not really, and that's more of a front, kind of a sideshow thing.
Right.
But what I think a lot of the cults and these darker elements, I do believe that there's, you know, a dark spiritual element to this stuff, but a lot of it is more so intelligence operations and blackmail. And that does tie directly into Hollywood. And I think that's what we saw, for example, with the Epstein. If we think back to the Clinton emails again and spirit cooking, which I think tied into the trips to Epstein's island, right?
Yeah.
If you remember that story from last year, that was, as I can gather, kind of a blackmail operation, right? So you get people fly to this thing and they, you know, they're with underage girls or with prostitutes or whatever. And, you know, it's wired for surveillance. That was what was going on with the Craig Spence, Johnny Gosch, Franklin cover-up. Right.
That was a good old story. Yeah, that was like 2005 or something. When was that again? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is long. This is old school stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, this has been going on for forever. This is, you know, blackmail politician. I mean, this is what was going on with Saville, and I believe one of the MI5 or somebody had one of those callboy houses tapped.
Right.
In England.
Yeah, BBC, Jimmy Savile, that whole story. Yeah.
But so this is how you control people, right? And so what I'm saying is that, is there a satanic? Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, are easily duped into believing that, if I join Church of Satan or something, I'm going to go get power and self-will and self-motivation and all this stuff or whatever. But, you know, you can find connections between John Kerry and Anton LaVey. So what that suggests to me is, that Skull and Bones, which is really just the CIA, is that was more of an intelligence front that was, you know, testing out new religious movements. Scientology's had a long connection to the CIA. And it's probably the same with Kabbalah, right? That probably has Mossad connections or something like that. And it's the same with the cult or fringe religious movement. I mean, look at the Esalen Institute out there in Big Sur. I mean, it's got some of the top people of the 20th century. You know, you've got Aldous Huxley. You've got, I think, Deepak Chopra, right, is part of that. These are people who are linked into this, and they may not. I'm not saying they're like necessarily James Bond or like CIA operatives, but that's not what the CIA is anyway. And that's what I go into in my book, is kind of filtering out the nonsense in the films and trying to get at what's real. And it's more like a cult than it is like a James Bond type thing.
Yeah. Maybe we should view all of this, that it's not like an ideologically driven kind of religion or anything like that they're trying to push. Is, I think we have to rethink a little bit, and I'm sure you have, but it's this idea that they will find and they will use whatever latest esoteric occult methodology or principle that they can to advance their intelligence work and their ability to control and manipulate people, right?
Oh, yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, I mean, well, think about the way that Kubrick explains things in Eyes Wide Shut.
I wanted to just get into that. Yeah, please go ahead.
If you've seen the movie, you've got basically this cult in the background. And if you think about who's part of this cult, it includes a relatively wide spectrum of society. So you've got Nick Nightingale, who's the musician, right? He's the piano player for the ceremony. You've got the recruitment of Bill, the Tom Cruise character, I believe he's being led into the cult, is kind of the point of the movie. Bill's, upper middle class, nouveau riche doctor in New York. He's being led into this group. And who's running the group? Well, it's some dude from England who's kind of the hierophant of the cult there. supermodels, right?
Yep.
Quote upper class or elite or whatever terms. That's who's involved in this this cadre. And yes, they seem to have this spiritual or sex magic or orgiastic Dionysian component to it, but they also seem to have all the tactics and means of, at their disposal that an intelligence agency has. So they're able to manipulate Bill in his daily life. They're able to put people into his life who are apparently honey traps or swallow type spies with the character of Domino. They're able to alter the news when the girl offers herself up as a sacrificial redemption for Bill at the end of the film. They're able to completely change the news story to say that she committed suicide, right? When obviously they had killed her or she killed herself or whatever. But the cult was behind that. So they have the ability to influence the news. They have the ability to track Bill. You know, they have people spying on him, kind of following him around town and so forth. So all of that is going on as well. So it's not just a, you know, it's kind of a cult thing. But I mention all that in my book, and I go into, you know, other people who've talked about sort of ritualized orgies and things like this. And, you know, we saw this actually come out with the character Dominique Strauss-Kahn, right? The French socialist banker character who was embroiled in a scandal when Sarkozy was running again and was able to win the election because Strauss-Kahn, they outed this story of him and some maid or something. But then it also came out that he was attending Eyes Wide Shut type parties, according to the New York Times. So in other words, that's just one of, you know, many examples.
I remember he hired these CIA specialists afterward to kind of mm-hmm. clean up his record and stuff like that too. I think to try to turn the story around and say he was actually framed because of other issues. Mm-hmm. But this shows again how much power they can have when they can completely manipulate perception of, like, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of this, you have no idea what actually happened. Was he framed because of something he's actually tried to do that counters the elite? Or, you know, it's just very interesting. But that was a interesting case. They do come to the surface now and then, these kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. And it's up to us to pay attention and connect the dots when they do.
Exactly. Yeah, I cite you know, similar cases from Dave McGowan's book, Program to Kill, pertaining to the Belgian Dutroux affair, where, you know, you had these girls that were involved in human trafficking and locked up in cages and so forth, and that being covered up in the European Union. And so that's just one of, you know, more of these examples of this kind of stuff really going on in the world.
You know, the latest thing, and you mentioned it, of course, that's bloomed out is this accusation with the Podesta emails, everything from, yeah, Moloch being mentioned in one of them, the DNC emails of sacrificing chickens, I believe, or something. I still don't know if that was a joke or not, but it's interesting that these kinds of things do come out. But the latest kind of version of this is the Pizzagate issue. And mm-hmm. I haven't, you know, specifically looked into this one, but it's something with comment pizza. He was seen, of course, in the Podesta's home. This ideas of one of the guys there posting Instagram pictures with, like, hashtags like chicken lovers, which is like mm-hmm. a slang for, you know, men who like younger boys, I believe, or maybe it was younger girls. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But this is nothing new to, you know, nut job conspiracy theorists like us, right? We've been talking about this for, you know, over a decade now of, like, you know, all these groups, all these, you know, conglomerates that seem to have a streak of pedophilia, of very, very filthy and disgusting behavior. And now and then, as I said, they do come to the surface, the Jimmy Savills. And you realize when you have a big kind of overview of this, that these are not isolated incidences. They are actually connected. And it seems to be that this is part of a more or less a global network of mm-hmm. pedophiles, right?
Well, and what's interesting is that, you know, think what you will of Kubrick. He seems to be saying this in a lot of his films. So, for example, that's kind of the plot of Lolita, right? Which right. is obvious what yeah. that movie's about. In Eyes Wide Shut, you have Lily Sobieski playing the young girl who is being trafficked by the, I guess he's some kind of Eastern European guy, Mr. Milich at the costume shop. He's pimping out who he says is his daughter, right? She's obviously underage.
Yeah, to like Chinese businessmen or something like that.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Barry Lyndon, if I recall, the Kubrick film includes the themes of underage relations and so forth and trauma in that regard. So, yes, I would say that it's even in a kind of throwing it in your face way. It's been shown in films. Most obvious one, The Shining. If you remember, little boy, the main character, he has been abused by his dad. Now it's kind of subtle, but if you watch the movie, and I go into this in my chapter on The Shining, he's been abused, and that's why he has this kind of dissociative state, and he's traumatized and so forth. And we even see Jack Nicholson in one scene, for example, he's looking at a playgirl. So there's this kind of homoerotic sort of hinting about Jack Nicholson's character. And the scene where Danny comes back after having been beat up, it's hinted, obviously he couldn't show that, but it's hinted that he was actually molested. So once again, Kubrick is dealing with this theme.
What do you think he's trying to convey here?
People keep asking me that about him. I don't know, because I can't. I honestly don't know. I mean, I'm not a Kubrick expert. I read a few books on him. I was mainly interested in the films, not so much his own psyche or whatever. He seems to have been just kind of a standard leftist, would be my guess. Maybe he was into darker occultic stuff. Maybe he was trying to say some truth. I honestly don't know.
Yeah, it seems to me that he is warning about something. I mean, if you take a bigger view again and look at the all of his work kind of put together, despite the fact that it's very different themes of the movies, there's different settings, it's different times, different epochs, there are these messages that come through that resonate with each other. You can find you can connect the dots, that's what I'm saying, between all of these movies, and see that it's almost like that he got an insight into a world which the rest of the world doesn't even understand exists. We don't know what that is. And he has tried to use the art form of movies to convey this in such a way that it's not overt, it's not in your face, but it seems, I mean, this is the conspiracy theory here, but it seems that Eyes Wide Shut was dangerously close enough to somehow threaten him personally, because of course he died before the movie was completed, and there were questions about the editing and how this was pulled together. Was this what he wanted to have seen with the film, etc.? It's a very fascinating story, though, with Kubrick.
Yeah, it is. I honestly don't know enough about that. I get a lot of people asking me that, but like I said, my main focus in the book is more so film analysis. So it's not Kubrick analysis, it's film analysis. So, there's a lot of every one of these people, you could do your own book on them. I mean, Hitchcock is a fascinating character. He worked for the British Ministry of Information, filming propaganda, actually. Right. A lot of people don't know that, but he filmed some Holocaust footage.
That's right. That's right.
So a lot of people don't know that, but... let's see, Ian Fleming, obviously he's a super interesting character. I've got a whole 80 pages of his Bond stories in there, he was involved in psychological operations and British psyops and as a naval intelligence officer. And a lot of the Bond stories are obviously based on him and other aggregate conglomerate characters that he kind of melded together, Maxwell Knight and so forth. But I mean, yeah, any one of the directors you could pick out, and they have curious, colorful backgrounds and lifestyles.
Oh, indeed, very much so. Well, we're going to take a break here shortly and discuss more movies in the second segment when we come back. And I wanted to return to the initial question that I did ask Jay as well, in terms of maybe how we can use some of this knowledge ourselves to help to destroy. And also, I want to talk about what actually is happening to Hollywood, because some of the recent news have come out is talking about the fact that many Chinese billionaires by now is actually buying up major studios in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And we can talk a bit about the future of Hollywood. Where is this going? Has Hollywood as it exists served its purpose, etc.? There's a lot of interesting questions left to go here. But tell folks, Jay, a little bit more about the book and where they can get a copy of it, and if there's something more they should know about it before we take a break.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's been a little bit of a change in the deal, so actually the best place to get it would be directly from me. So if you go to Jay's Analysis, you'll see in the contact information you can email me and get a copy directly from me is the best way to do it. I come out the best in that regard. If you're in another country, that's probably not the best route. If you're outside the U.S. is something like Amazon. So those are the two best ways to get the book.
Very good. JasonAnalysis.com. We'll have links up, of course, on the website. And yeah, it's very fascinating. Let's take a short break here, folks. We'll return with a second hour shortly. Stay tuned. Red Ice is 100% viewer and listener supported. No ads, no sponsors. Help us grow and expand our coverage. Sign up for a membership. Get full access to everything that we produce. That includes all archived Red Ice radio shows, both ours. We also have Radio 314, our live TV show, Weekend Warrior, video versions of some of our interviews, and your membership also helps to fund our public live stream coverage of important events, like we saw this past weekend with the MPI event in Washington, D.C. And I'd say what a relief that we did that, because now people can actually see the speeches themselves. They can see the entire event. They can actually see what happened and make up their own mind instead of going to the lying mainstream media that are not only misrepresenting and flat-out lying, but they might even have had their own well-placed men on location to get their money shot, as we saw in that Atlantic video. And this is, of course, designed to simply just show that we are really just a bunch of basement-dwelling Nazis that have no legitimate concerns whatsoever. Well, we have now been able to prove them wrong on this point, and people can actually see for themselves. And this is the job of truthful media. Not to lie, not to make things up for your own political conniving purposes. So help us do more of these events and bring you more content. This comes at a time when the lying mainstream media is crumbling. So your support of truly independent media from the right perspective has never been more important. Help us bring out this information so that we can tell people what really is going on and what the masters of globalism is trying to do to us and the future of European and Western civilization. Get a hold of a membership today. That's really the best way to support us. It's €6 per month. And I think the US dollar is equal to that by now. So it's $6 per month. We have subs from 3 months up to 2 years available. Please join us at redicemembers.com. We're going to continue right now. Hour 2 with Jay Dyer is coming up. And also, of course, don't miss our Weekend Warrior live show on Sunday, the 27th. So stay tuned for that. We'll talk to you right after this break. Thank you for listening.